Right, okay. So, title of the talk is Should Animal Rights Be Part of the Socialist Case? Right, I'm going to talk for about an hour and a half. Oh, sorry. I almost said an hour and a half. Don't panic, but for about half an hour. I'll start with something personal. Up until a few months ago, I'd been a vegetarian for close on 40 years. Then I did what I'd been wanting to do for a long time, and something I hadn't been able to manage. I went vegan. Now, I can assure you that this isn't any kind of self-congratulation. During the time I was a vegetarian, I never tried to proselytize or to claim any kind of moral superiority. In fact, more often than not, I found myself apologizing. In fact, on the whole, I didn't talk about it. The view I took and still do take largely was that from the point of view of health, you can have a good or bad diet of any kind. And as to whether vegetarianism is better for the environment, well, to a certain extent, I've always thought the jury was out on that. No, my reason for doing it was encapsulated by the words of the writer, Isaac Bashevis Singer, famous Nobel Prize winner, who once said, I did not become a vegetarian for my health, I did it for the health of the chickens. But I did think it would be difficult to be a vegan, so dependent was I on dairy products, in particular milk and an unexpected breeze. There's just so much plant-based food of all description available now, and the non-plant-based stuff I felt dependent on is very easily replaced. At least it has been for me. What caused this to happen at what for me is a pretty late stage? Well, a friend who organizes a plant-based food group suggested I watch a webinar they'd organized by a well-known American doctor and vegan advocate, Michael Clapper. I did watch it, and though he was laid back and not openly trying to convert, it was powerful and compelling for me, and I decided I wanted to give it a go. His talk had three strands: health, environment, and animal cruelty. And though the first two did give serious food for thought, it was mainly the third one that grabbed me. Similar talk by the same person, Michael Clapper, is on YouTube, by the way, and I've put a link to it on the useful links page in case anyone is interested in looking, but not now. It's not very long. It's about 20 minutes or so long, but you can look at that anytime you want. Anyway, that's just by way of introduction so that you'll know where I am from a personal point of view. But I'll be less personal now and begin by saying that the more general move towards vegetarianism and veganism in the Western world over the last 50 years or so is, in part at least, the outcome of significant campaigns people have waged against animal cruelty, abuse, and general exploitation of them. So today we have not only long-standing organizations such as the RSPCA, the League Against Cruel Sports, and the Anti-Vivisection Society, but many more recent ones like Animal Aid, Compassion in World Farming, the Humane League, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, the International Fund for Animal Welfare, Cruelty Free International, the Network for Animals, and many more. 81 of them, in fact, are listed on the Wikipedia page for pro-animal organizations. And there are strong feelings. Some time ago, a letter appeared in a national newspaper from a reader who said that his wife had died of cancer, and had legislation not been passed limiting the use of animal experiments, a cure may have been found and she might still be alive. This elicited a strong response from readers, one of them saying that the writer was mistaken, since none of the legislation brought in since the Cruelty to Animals Act of 1876 had actually stopped experiments taking place. All it had done And the writer here was referring to the subsequent 1986 Act, far from limiting experiments, was just to grade them from 1 to 5, according to the intensity of pain they caused. This response went on to say that this legislation had actually made things worse for animals, since it no longer insisted that animals be killed after they'd been experimented on, but allowed them to be used for a second experiment if they were still in a fit condition. So what do the animal experiment campaigners campaign against? Well, it's not just medical experiments. It's also tests on animals for, say, cosmetics, weed killer, alcohol, weapons, and behavioral and psychological tests. And we could add to this products like oven cleaner, candles, shampoo, polish, antifreeze, detergents. And campaigners have actually succeeded in reducing the use of animals for some of these purposes. So it's easy nowadays to find lists of, for example, cruelty-free cosmetics and to buy cleaning products. I bought one the other day, a cleaning spray marked vegan. So despite this, but if we want to put actual figures on it, it's estimated that every day up to 10,000 animals are experimented on in laboratories in Britain, largely without anaesthetic. An animal dies in a lab, therefore, about every 8 seconds. And this happens in various ways. I won't go into the most grisly details, but animals of various kinds are burned, blinded, scalded, poisoned, cut up, etc. In all, we're looking at around 3.5 million procedures a year in this country. And that figure's remained pretty constant over the last 35 years. The figure worldwide is estimated to be around 115 million per year, with the top animal testing countries being China, Japan, and the United States. That said, the largest use of animals for what one might call human purposes is for clothing, furniture, and in particular, food. For the first two of these, clothing and furniture, campaigners have been relatively successful in some ways, for example, in limiting the use of some animal fur. But animals are still often cruelly raised and slaughtered for their fur or skin. We recently heard about the mink farms in Denmark, where 70 million mink were slaughtered a few weeks ago because of coronavirus. If they hadn't been, it wouldn't have made a lot of difference in a sense, because they would have been kept in cages before being gassed or electrocuted for their fur. Some time ago, I received a letter from the Save the Seals campaign of the International Fund for Animal Welfare. It contained a small folded brochure with a warning message on the outside, and it showed Canadian fishermen killing baby seals, and it graphically described their clubbing to death. And now I read only a couple of days ago that the fashion brand Hermes plans to farm 50,000 crocodiles for skinning and turning into handbags. But the most widespread use of animals for human purposes is obviously for food. According to data from the Food and Agriculture Organization, in 2016, 1.1 billion land animals were slaughtered for food in the UK alone. It's actually hard to know exact figures, in fact, because elsewhere I've seen 1.6 billion. But anyway, it's a lot. And that's the UK's contribution to an estimated 77 billion killed worldwide. That number has actually increased around sevenfold, despite all the campaigning. It's increased around sevenfold over the last 60 years, largely because of a dramatic rise in chicken slaughter and a big increase in the consumption of pig meat, especially in the Far East. For the other animals, it's gone down a bit. And this is just land animals and doesn't include fish and shellfish, for which the global figure for creatures killed every day for food is around 3 million. 3 million every day. So for the UK, if we add together the number of land animals and sea animals killed annually as part of the food supply, we're looking at around 6.4 billion. However, in the UK, the welfare of farmed animals is in theory, at least, you wouldn't imagine it, but it is in theory at least protected by the Animal Welfare Act of 2006, which makes it an offence to cause unnecessary suffering to any animal. The Act also contains what it calls a duty of care to animals, which says that anyone responsible for an animal must take reasonable steps to make sure the animal's welfare needs are met. That's the theory anyway. But it very much depends, of course, how terms like reasonable steps, unnecessary suffering, and welfare are interpreted. So in the intensive industrialized farming system, which is widespread in most of the world, it's estimated by the Humane League that around 130 billion animals suffer every day. One example it points to is the common practice, both in this country and elsewhere, of calves not considered suitable to be raised for veal, being taken from their mothers on the first day of life and shot in the head or hammered to death. It points out that many of the animals that do make it to the slaughterhouse end their lives screaming, wailing, and shaking violently before they die. In addition to this, there's the hunting of wild animals, on which there are very few legal restrictions. And some of the practices used in this are truly fiendish. In France, for example, glue is used on trees on a large scale to catch songbirds, which are then left there as bait for other larger birds, which can later be shot by hunters. Late last year, the Mail Online published an article headed Warning Graphic Content, which talked about a new book of photographs published by animal campaigners. It was called A Hidden World of Animal Suffering, and it showed horrific pictures of animal cruelty from around the world. I won't go into detail here, but if anyone wants to read the article or to see the photos that accompany it, I put the link on the Useful Links page. Now, most people here will probably know that we're still in the month of Veganuary, the month assigned by vegan campaigners for people to try giving up food from animal products and to eat only plant-based food. The Vegan Society sees this as a bid, I quote from their literature, to exclude as far as is possible and practicable all forms of exploitation and cruelty to animals for food, clothing, or any other purpose. End of quote. And it's often presented not just as a way of saving the animals, but as a way of being more healthy, of saving the environment, and also reducing or even getting rid of hunger and starvation. One of the ideas that underlies this and unites all animal rights campaigners is that since animals can't organize their own protest, they must be protected by those who can. One of their slogans is, "We are the voice for the voiceless." My personal view is that it's impossible not to be sympathetic to that voice, and indeed to the millions of creatures it speaks for. I'll quote again from Isaac Bashevis Singer, the Nobel Prize-winning Yiddish-American writer who I mentioned earlier. The way he famously and graphically put it was, "The concentration camps are closed, but for the animals, every day is Treblinka." Now, the question is, in the society we live in, can that voice for the voiceless, be effective? Well, it must be said it's had some effect, at least in the West, even if it hasn't been as successful as campaigners might have hoped in reducing animal experimentation or bringing improvement to conditions for food animals. An increasing number of people have turned to vegetarianism or veganism, or at least are eating less meat or fish. I don't think I need to give figures to show this, because the evidence is right there in front of us. Every time we visit a supermarket, we see an increasingly wide selection of explicitly vegan and vegetarian products on the shelves. And if people weren't buying them, clearly they wouldn't be there. the difference compared even to just 10 or 20 years ago is really striking. So some progress in some countries with reducing the use of animals for food, but is it likely that with continued sustained campaigning, animal experimentation too can be reduced or even eliminated? In this area, the animal campaigners point to alternative methods of experimentation that could be used and are already being used to a certain extent, in particular, so-called in vitro methods consisting of the use of cell and tissue cultures, which avoids the direct use of animals and can utilize human samples taken from such sources as, for example, tissue removed during surgical procedures. Human cultures of this kind have already been used for research into diseases such as cancer, diabetes, arthritis, for drug and toxicity testing, and for the production of vaccines, hormones, and enzymes. There are also now so-called in silico models, which are advanced computer modeling techniques to replicate very many aspects of the human body, heart, lungs, kidney, etc. And there are also other methods being continually developed. For example, chemical analysis by mass spectrometry, genetic engineering, and scanning by sophisticated photographic techniques. It's also pointed out by the campaigners that experiments on animals, apart from being cruel, can produce dangerously misleading results that may be inapplicable to humans. Animal bodies often react differently to drugs than human ones, and there is a history of animal-tested drugs having adverse, sometimes disastrous effects on humans. So why, given the existence and even use of other methods, are animals still dying in their millions in experimentation? The answer is quite simply that animals are usually cheaper. We know that the primary aim of research, as of all other productive activity in today's world, is not to alleviate suffering. It may do that, but first and foremost, it has to yield products that can be sold at a profit. We're seeing that with this with the coronavirus vaccine business now, aren't we? Products that can be sold at a profit, or at least will smooth the overall running of the profit process. In these circumstances, cost, cheapness has to be the single most essential factor. No firm producing drugs, cosmetics, oven cleaner or detergents, or whatever, will pay for research without the prospect of a product they can sell at a profit. And since it has also to be assessed whether the amount of resources being put into a research project is worth the profit it will finally yield, research sponsors or investors will inevitably want the work to be carried out as cheaply as possible. And if cheapness means using animals rather than other methods that may in fact be available, then in the system we live under, animals will be used and will suffer. Now, animal rights groups do often recognize that profit is the driving force of animal exploitation, but unfortunately, they never seem to look beyond the profit system for a possible solution to the problem. They would like compassion to enter into the production process. However, if the driving force of production in capitalism is profit, as we would argue it is, then can compassion for animals come anywhere but a poor second? And this is especially the case when we consider that compassion for humans so often comes a poor second to profit. Every year, millions of human beings are killed, maimed, ill-treated, driven from their homes, etc., in the wars and power struggles associated with the capitalist system, with its pursuit of profit in many parts of the globe. Every year, millions of human beings are allowed to go hungry or even die of starvation. And that's because they can't afford to buy food at a price that would allow its production or distribution to be profitable. I picked up in Paddy's talk last week that the number who die of starvation because they can't afford to buy food is around 25,000 a day, 9 million a year. In addition, every year, millions of human beings, even in so-called advanced countries like Britain, are set at odds with one another by the competitive ethic and by the hostile social environment of the profit system. Many are victims of material want, mental distress, which can in turn lead to problems like violence, theft, drug addiction, suicide, and even death by poor living conditions. So can we truly expect compassion for animals on any significant scale? This is my point. In a society whose social organisation, despite any lip service that may be paid, a society whose social organisation militates so much against compassion for human beings. In the end, the necessary change that needs to take place doesn't involve attempting to run the current system more fairly or more compassionately. We'll never get far with that. The necessary change, and I think most of the people here this evening will agree with this, preaching to the converted, I know, but the necessary change is to a system, a society where production is for use, not profit, where people cooperate voluntarily to produce what they need and enjoy free and equal access to what they produced. So what we're talking about here is a society without wages and salaries, without buying and selling, without money and banks and stock exchanges, etc. And of course, it seems a tall order, but it's entirely within our grasp once the majority of us decide we want it and are prepared to take democratic political action to bring it about. And it's certainly less of a tall order than trying to emancipate animals or humans in the framework of the present society. So in light of this, how would I answer the question that's the title of this session, should animal rights be part of the socialist case? Well, I've noticed that in their letters to the press, anti-vivisectionists have the habit of signing off with a yours for human and animal rights. And in doing that, they're actually highlighting the similarity of their position to the countless other organisations campaigning not for animal rights, but for human rights. Organisations like Shelter, Help the Aged, Oxfam, Amnesty International, War on Want, Child Poverty Action, and so on. And both sets of rights campaigners have the same dilemma. They're campaigning for rights within the framework of a system where any such notion, any notion of rights, must always be subordinated to the needs of profit. In other words, they're fighting to get rid of problems without aiming to get rid of the system that produces those problems. And it's a system that produces a bottomless pit of them for both humans and animals. So that kind of fight must always be a losing one. Calming the symptoms, calming the pain, put it like that maybe, is the best it can hope for. Because so long as the root cause of the pain is still there, then that pain will keep coming back. And indeed, it will, as it does, break out in other places too. So the conclusion I'm driven to is that campaigning for animal rights, as for human rights, within the framework of present society cannot be part of the case for an entirely different society. I mean, the socialist one we in the World Socialist Movement campaign for and want to see. And in connection with this, there's another interesting link, I think, which I put on the Useful Links page, and it's a short piece on rights by the American comedian, who died quite a short time ago, much lamented American comedian George Carlin. Finally, will the position of animals be different in the kind of different society I've outlined? what we call a socialist society. Well, it's impossible to know exactly, because we can't know exactly what the world will be like when the majority of workers decide they want a different kind of global society and take political action to bring it about. But my personal view is that just as in that different kind of world where the peace and security of socialism will mean that people's attitudes towards their fellow human beings will be different, it's hard to imagine that their attitudes towards animals will not be different too. At the moment, we're socialized to eat meat, and most people do. But many meaters do have compunction. They do somehow feel something a bit wrong with it, and some have started to eat less. I actually picked up something of that in a discussion we had here a couple of weeks or so ago, when a meat-eating comrade said he thought and hoped that socialism would be a non-meat-eating society. I must say that cheered me. I hope that too, though of course I can't, I hope that too, though of course I can't guarantee it. But surely in a truly human society, compassion for other living creatures can hardly fail to be something that will concern us. But will animal experiments still be needed, say, for the treatment of diseases? Because despite improved conditions, diseases surely won't disappear altogether in socialism. Well, first of all, in a society where cost factors do not come before human need, my own thought is that all methods of research that exist will be used in preference to making animals suffer. Above all, we'll think carefully before condemning other sentient beings to suffering or death. When people take their democratic decisions on these matters, and of course all decisions in socialism will be democratic, people will have to weigh the benefit to themselves and to the community as a whole of using or inflicting pain on animals against the potential debasement of humanity that this involves. They'll have to ask themselves whether the benefit to humanity is so vital as to be worth causing defenseless creatures to suffer. My speculation, and yes, it is speculation, of course, is that it will rarely, if ever, be considered vital. So should animal rights be part of the case for socialism? Well, no, for the reasons I hope I've explained. But in a socialist society, what I also hope will happen is that, as argued by the animal rights advocate Peter Singer, animals will have their interests considered throughout their lives. And this will eliminate from our thoughts what he calls speciesism, the notion that animals are below us and we can do what we want with them. I also hope, as another writer has said, that in the society we're aiming for, factory farms and slaughterhouses will disappear, though we may want to keep a few standing as monuments for future generations to visit. That's it. Thank you very much.
Like a lot of other people, I have a bit of a disconnect as to, I eat meat, not an awful lot, but a disconnect between buying meat and trying to think of where it's come from and actually how it has been slaughtered. And I'm afraid that even though organic and free range, I think it probably does involve animal cruelty, and I'm a bit ashamed, really. So thanks, Howard. Okay, floor is open. Moggy.
Hello, thank you very much, Howard. That was a wonderful talk. I must confess, I occasionally eat a bit of meat. My daughter is vegan, and she said to me one day when I was eating a bit of meat, she said, if you want to go out and kill that yourself, you'd be vegetarian quick as anything. I said, yes, you're quite right. It was a real eye-opener hearing that bit about in France, about them putting glue on trees and sticking the birds up. By crikey, they'd never get away with that in New Zealand. People are very, very conscious. Although we are a farming family, a farming country, people are very conscious of looking after animals and animal rights. And in fact, just last week in Dunedin in the South Island, the city council closed one of the main roads because a mother sea lion had come ashore and she'd given birth to a pup on the local golf links. So they closed the main road so that she had access to the sea each day to do her fishing. And so things like that, you know, people really, I mean, they'll close the road if the penguins are coming across or something. And we do have an organization called Safe for Animals, which you might like to look at their website sometime. But although I'm very much in favor of vegetarianism, I'm not sure I'm quite so much in favor of veganism. Sheep are still going to produce wool, whether we use it or not. And if they carry too much wool, it's just a burden to them. We've had one or two examples on television of sheep that have sort of got away from the flock and they've been running wild for a few years. And then when they're found, they've got this enormous fleece and they can hardly walk around. And they feel so much better when it's been taken off them. What I'm not in favour of is, because of the profit motive, farmers will often shear their sheep in the middle of winter, which I think is damn cruel, you know, because then they're cold, they're exposed to the snow. And also they organise the breeding so that the lambs are born in the winter rather than in the summertime. And so I think that's terrible. They shouldn't be doing that. But I'm all in favour of shearing sheep and producing the wool because we can use the wool, and it's I think the sheep are quite glad to get rid of a big fleece. Hens are still going to lay eggs, whether they've been fertilised or not. I'm not in favour of hens being kept in cages or in barns. But we do have a lot of free-range farms in New Zealand where hens can run around over several hectares of land, and they've got a big open-ended barn to shelter in. And so I think there's nothing wrong with eating free-range eggs, because if those eggs haven't been fertilised, they're not going to hatch anyway. And goats will still produce milk. Far more than they actually need to feed their babies, and that can be turned into beautiful cheeses. Bees are still going to produce honey, whether we use it or not, and honey, well, particularly Manuka honey, has a lot of health benefits for people. So I'm all in favour of using wool, eating eggs, drinking goat's milk and eating honey. So I just wonder what other people feel like, you know, about that sort of thing.
I want to come back on that, Howard.
Yeah, if I can just say a word or two in response. Good for New Zealand, Moggy, that, you know, the good things that that people there do for animals that you mentioned early on in your in what you had to say just now. Yeah, that happens to a certain extent everywhere, though, doesn't it? I mean, people do, on an individual level, go out of their way to treat animals well. There was something only yesterday I noticed on the BBC News website about an orca whale that had got stranded, and half a dozen people went to enormous lengths. You imagine the size of an orca whale to lift it up and get it into deeper water, and it was able to. It was able to swim away. All sorts of individual acts like this take place every day, not just, you know, not just for animals, but for people as well. The trouble is the system as a whole swamps this, militates against it, swamps it in the way it's actually organised, in terms of the social organisation we live in. The other thing, the various kinds of sort of animal products you talked about, wool and eggs and so on. I don't entirely disagree with some of the things you said. I mean, if sheep are going to suffer because they're not shorn, well, by all means, you know, use their wool as long as it's not done cruelly. There's obviously nothing wrong with that. The things that you mention are sort of on the edges of inappropriate treatment of animals. But I mean, you know, the real problems, the real sort of cruelty that comes from experimentation and sort of mass production of meat and fish products.
I'm assuming you've seen the comment from Adam here.
Sorry, I'm not on that page. I will go on it.
Oh, I just wondered if you'd like to respond to it.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know Adam was here, actually. Let me find it now.
It's on the
speaking queue.
Speaking queue.
Okay. I like it. Adam and I had an argument about this many years ago on the pages of the Socialist Standard. He'll tell you about it, no doubt. He'll give you his version anyway. And I don't think Adam and I are going to agree on this. I mean, Adam's argument, I think, is that in socialism, people will eat meat, and that's all. Well, all right, that's all there is to it. Maybe he wouldn't accept that's what he says, but certainly that was what that was the idea that he gave on that occasion.
Okay, Adam, do you want to chip in or?
It doesn't matter if he doesn't.
Okay, Brian.
No, just say that, you know, that the talk that I would gave sounded very much like the socialist case, or the socialist approach to animal compassion in a socialist society. There's not much we can do about it now, right? Because there's so many animals that's been domesticated, and if they were left to their own welfare, so be it. Like, you know, turn around and say, right, well, we're no longer domesticating animals. We'd end up with the problems of Moggy related to the sheep shearing. They can't shear themselves. And consequently, they would suffer harm themselves because due to the domestication that they've gone through, right, and things like that. And again, then the beef lots that we've got, it'd mean opening up all that beef to their own, whichever ways they can survive, right? And I can't see that occurring. No, there'd be a terrible amount of adjustments come to society in regards to animal compassion. That's obvious.
Yeah, just to say, I like that, Brian. What I was putting forward wasn't the socialist case. If there is a socialist case on this, but I would strongly argue at least that it's a socialist approach.
Okay, Paddy.
I enjoyed the talk, Howard. I was a little bit surprised at the angle you took on it, though. There are a lot of vegetarians, vegans, who take what I would call a kind of moral line on meat farming. I mean, and you did yourself. I mean, it's clearly, when you look at it up close, it's quite a hideous practice. And what Carla said is right. I think if most people actually had to walk around an abattoir, it would make them probably think twice about the whole business. It is really quite hideous. I mean, what Bashevis Singer said about it, you know, it's a Treblinka every day for animals. It's not far from the truth, really. But in a sense, I think that's also what's wrong with the argument, in the sense of when you ask, you know, should this be part of the party case? Well, no. It can't be part of the party case because it's a moral argument, and moral arguments don't really work very well. And I would question whether it's actually the best argument to put forward. It's not the one that I personally favour. The one that I would favour is the environmental argument instead of the moral argument. So, for example, facts and figures, just, you know, I've just quickly looked on something called One Green Planet. So of the available farmland in the world, 50% of that is used for agriculture. And of that 50%, 77% is used for livestock. But all this livestock produces only a quarter of the protein and calories than the land given over to grain, vegetable farming. So in other words, it's taking four times the land but producing one quarter of the calories and protein. I think that's by itself is a strong argument against the meat industry. Somebody said, you know, oh dear, sheep can't shear themselves. I mean, forget that. If you were decided to go against meat farming, there wouldn't be any sheep to shear themselves. That's a ridiculous idea. It's like people saying, if we didn't eat cows, we'd be overrun with cow populations. No, we just wouldn't breed them in the first place. And the argument, and I've heard scientists put this forward, that much of the land is unsuitable for agriculture because it's uneven, it's hilly, it's rolling, this sort of thing. What they really mean is it's not unsuitable for agriculture, it's simply unsuitable for large-scale commercial agriculture using big industrial combines that need flat land. But if you worked it in small plots, in small holdings, you could easily use it for vegetable farming, for grain farming, that sort of thing. It doesn't have to be given over to animal farming the way it is. And that includes New Zealand, by the way. So it's not necessary. It's not necessarily true at all that some land is only suitable for meat farming. But that, again, that's not a moral argument. That's simply an argument about best use of resources. And I think, just to add one further rider to this, is that could it be a part of the socialist case in that case? I think it could, because I think that socialists should be advocating a sustainable food production process for the globe. And that is blatantly not an animal production system. At the moment, the way that production is carried on in the world right to today would require 1.7 planets. It's not sustainable at the moment. It's been variously estimated that if the developing world, which they're trying to do, all aspires to a Western-style meat diet, we would then require between 3 and 5 planets. These aren't moral arguments. These are environmental arguments. I think they're very strong. I've never seen them refuted anywhere. I think it's the responsibility of socialists to put these environmental arguments against meat farming and forget the moral qualms that people have.
Thanks, Paddy. Can't disagree with anything you've said. I've actually got voluminous notes on this, which I didn't use in the end because I chose to sort of adopt a different approach. And I did say at the beginning that, and that's why at the beginning I was sort of careful to say that I do have a personal view on this, which is going to condition the kind of thing I'm going to say. But yes, you're absolutely right. The two major destroyers of forest and wildlife are beef and leather. The loss of forests is one of the single biggest contributors to climate change. I've got a figure here which says a nearly complete switch to a plant-rich diet around the world could slash almost 720 billion tons of greenhouse gases. So, very powerful arguments, very powerful environmental arguments. Perhaps I should have included them. I didn't. Sorry about that, but I would entirely agree. I think I did sort of make similar points in a talk I gave sort of some time ago about food based on a book called Sitopia. You may remember that, where similar arguments were put forward. And I said that they were, as far as I could see, that they were obviously irrefutable. So, yeah, okay, sorry you didn't like my approach, but I certainly agree with what you're saying about, I mean, I don't think we should get too much into arguing that within capitalism we need to do this, that and the other in order to improve the environment, because we know very well it ain't going to happen. But nevertheless, we do need to point it out.
Okay, there's quite a few people now wanting to come in. So, Mike Brown, did you want to actually physically speak?
No, not at the moment. Thanks, Carla. Go ahead to John Cummings, if you please.
Yes, I think the environmental arguments are by far the best ones to use. And I think as far as rights are concerned, only socialism will give any animals, including the human one, what we might call rights. When people talk to me about human rights, for example, I often put on a pseudo-naive attitude and say, oh, is that a new thing? What's that all about? Because, as you know, we're not accorded much of what you would call rights in society as at present constituted. So I do think that the environmental arguments are the best, but I think socialist society in the longer term will become a, I mean, I wouldn't swear to this, I mean, I've no way of controlling what happens, but I would suspect that once everyone's basic needs are satisfied, people would find the idea of causing suffering to other animals quite abhorrent. And I say that as someone who still does eat meat, but not massive amounts of it. But nonetheless, I think only socialism will make it possible to accord such things as rights to other animals as well as to ourselves. It's no accident that in capitalism, the animals are badly treated because of the profit motive. And it's no accident that the decreasing biodiversity is occurring because the animals that are dying out are the ones that can't be exploited or generally not exploited for food. So, again, it comes back to socialism being the framework in which we can have a more environmentally, ecologically sound society, and a society that works in the interests of, I would argue, not just the human animal, but all living creatures, all organisms, in fact. The planet as an ecosystem should be a system that works to the benefit of all living things. That's the only way for us ultimately to survive, never mind what happens to the other animals. So that's my kind of position on it.
Mark?
Sorry, I came in and went out again. Yeah, thanks, Howard. Thanks very much for that. And I think it was a very good combination to have the previous week's subject as well, which led the way. I have to say that I've actually been a vegan since 2019, and the summer school on ecology of 2017 had quite an impact. And I remember Paddy at the time, one of the first things he said is when he gave his veganism talk was, I'm not going to give any ethical arguments. I do agree with what Paddy said about the environment, but I disagree that that we shouldn't use moral arguments in the case of socialism. I think that the case of socialism, when we think about it, is actually shot through with moral arguments. I was just when I was thinking about this meeting, I my mind went back to the famous quote by Engels, who said that a nation cannot be free and at the same time continue to oppress other nations. Thus, Germany cannot be liberated without the liberation of Poland from oppression by Germans. I mean, that's part of the case that we make, that oppression of one nation by another, or oppression of one race by another, or oppression of one sex by another, or the oppression of children by the old, or the oppression of the old by the children. You know, that all of these things are an expression of a class society, of hierarchy, of a general lack of respect for the rights of other people. And I believe our claim is that in socialism, the overthrow of capitalism would provide the platform in which all other oppression can be overthrown. And I do believe, in fact, that we make those aspects of oppression part of the case against capitalism and against other previous forms of class society. And I cannot understand at all why we should think that the case for animal rights should be treated differently. Howard mentioned the word speciesism. I mean, can we not imagine that it's possible that we have become so used as human beings ever since at least the agricultural revolution of treating animals just as our property, just as our resource? And we may think we should do it humanely, but that we have the right to those animals, to their lives, to their children, to their product. And we should be kind. And perhaps if we're very kind, we wouldn't use them very much, but that we have the right to if we feel we need to. That's what I see as speciesism. And it may have been that if we were talking 100 years ago, people would be much less sensitive about women or much less sensitive about other races. I do not understand the statement that because treating animals as property is, which we do, is a moral, it was not really just a moral case, it's actually part of the way our society runs, treating other beings as property. But even if that is regarded as a moral argument, why shouldn't it be part of the case against the society we live in? And why shouldn't we contend for the right treatment of all sentient beings that include other human beings, but also include animals?
Howard, do you want to respond?
Not really, except to thank Mark for that and to agree certainly with most of it. And maybe I can sort of connect that with the comment underneath on the speaking queue where Adam says we're not a vegetarian party. You know, no, we're not a vegetarian party. And, you know, I made a point of saying that I don't think that animal rights should be part of the socialist case in the same way that human rights are not part of the socialist case, because, you know, in capitalism, they're both an impossibility. And, you know, Adam also says what people choose to eat is a private matter. Of course it is. But, I mean, in a socialist society, you'll only be able to eat meat if socialists decided that meat should be available, that animals should, you know, that animals should be slaughtered for meat. So it's both public and private. And I think, you know, anyone looking forward to the way a socialist society will be organised has got to bear that in mind.
Okay, thanks. Vin?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think some things are pretty obvious. Supposing the world goes on the way it is and then we get socialism. I mean, at the moment, what is it, 8.9% of the world are hungry. So, I mean, given all the very strong arguments that Paddy says about the land use, there's ways of that. And then there's also lots of places that are, you know, like that be cultivated that have absolutely no use whatsoever, like golf courses and Old Trafford, where Manchester United play, for example. You know, but notwithstanding that, you know, the first job of under socialism for us all is to feed the world. You know, and so there'll need to be a realignment and a lot less meat, you know, grown for food, because, you know, the planet can't sustain it at the moment. Once that very important job, and by far the most important thing yet we have to do at the beginning of socialism, feed everyone, then we can sort of like start thinking about resources. I mean, I admire Adam's stuff a lot, but eating isn't a private matter when, what is it, 690 million people are starving. That's my point.
Thank you, Vin. Mike Foster?
Hello there. Yeah. Thanks, Howard. That was a really interesting. I enjoyed that. Yeah, lots to think about. And I hadn't really seen the issue in that way before. I don't think I'd sort of thought it through. Something that popped into my head was something I remember hearing not too long ago on the news about rhino horns. Used as an aphrodisiac and a sort of traditional medicine, and of course, you know, rhinos are killed for the horns to be hacked off them, and the more scarce rhino horn is, the more expensive it gets, of course, and then that means that it's profitable to kill as many rhinos as possible, because everyone you kill drives the price up, extinction is directly profitable. And presumably, you know, rhino horn will be even more expensive once there aren't any rhinos to produce it. Anyway, I suppose another point, maybe more on in tune with what was being talked about just now, is I think in a socialist world, it wouldn't be a uniform sort of culture. You'd have some areas where meat eating is considered acceptable and it fits in with whatever way they're organizing themselves, and you'd have other parts of the world where it's not considered acceptable to eat or exploit animals, and people of course have the freedom to, you know, go to whichever community chimes with their own viewpoints, and I'd certainly, you know, head towards one of the ones where animal exploitation wasn't considered acceptable. So yeah, I suppose that just means that we can't, you know, go into too many specifics about a future socialist world. But yeah, my point was, I don't think it will be everyone on the planet having a shared viewpoint on the use of animals. You know, that's not going to happen. Yeah, thank you.
It's a bit confusing, people putting comments up. So I'm only going to go to those people that have got a Q under their name. Is that okay? Right, so the next one is Joel.
Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yeah, can hear you, Joel. Go ahead.
First of all, thanks for the informative talk, Howard. And also thank you, Paddy, for your environmental angle. I stopped eating meat a long, long time ago, but it wasn't a moral thing. It was just I was slowly and slowly eating less meat, so I just stopped. So I mean, I don't have any problems with people eating meat. I mean, it's I would never sort of admonish somebody for eating meat. And I've always looked at the thing about sort of meat and animal rights from a socialist point of view. So I mean, I've never sort of gotten a soapbox sort of like propagating not eating meat, because as somebody said, I mean, eating meat is, or what you eat is a private matter. And I think if you start criticising people's culinary habits, it can be a very touchy subject. But it's been a good talk. Thank you.
Can I just, quick response, yeah. Carla? Can I just
yes,
say...
Of course.
Joel, I don't have any problems with people eating meat either. I think I sort of said that at the beginning. You know, I don't admonish people. I never have. You know, people eat meat for all sorts of reasons. I mean, you know, very, very many do it because it's, I feel like it's sort of social conditioning. Perfectly understand. We all do all sorts of things through social conditioning that most of the time we don't even think about. So, That's okay. That's unproblematic. Yeah. I was just what I was trying to do was to sort of, you know, compare the way we see things now in this area to the way we might see things in socialism. And once again, I did say that it was speculative. You know, it's all got to be speculative because we don't know the details of how the future socialist society is going to be organized.
I mean with socialism, as we know, so many things will change, won't they? Our attitudes to people and our attitudes to sort of food, our attitudes to sort of what we want to listen to, or just it'll be such a complete change. And And like you said, I mean, one of them is probably people attitude to what they eat will change.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joel.